This is Terry Gibson, Cinema and Spirituality, October 26, 1991, tape 3 of 3.
And about conditions in our culture, and if we can take the time to receive it, even if they're films that feed the gratuitous values, inside it there are explicit statements arrested and frozen inside that film about the condition and the state and poverty of soul. Yeah, I would approach every film. I try to be open. And I have tastes. I mean, there are good films, there are A films that are art films and higher psyche, and then there are B beach party bikini films that are lower films. But when I get rid of my prejudices and I just try to watch that material, and I realize that a large number of the population goes to B-level films and enjoys them, and I start to say, why do they enjoy it, and how can I let myself enjoy it, and what is it in me is touched in here? What's unfinished that this film's trying to work through? I mean, think about the enormous amount of money our culture spends on the production. It's an incredible industry. Well, the gross national product, when the average film now costs, what, $7-8 million, even an expensive film? $20 million? I mean, just think about the enormous industry and money that we're spending on this art form. There's an active psychological process going on. So I try to be real open about all genres. Documentaries, horror films, bikini films, I think even pornography, if we were to look at it, has really important images about trying to seek conjunctio and try to not objectify the other, but really find a subjective. I mean, that's a real longing in all of that. And pornography is a distortion, but I think we could probably learn from those scripts in pornography. Violent films? If we get a chance, I've got two of Sam Peckinpah. Peckinpah built special machines so that violence could be more horrifying on the screen. He built special bleeding machines so he could rub our face in violence. And I've got a tail end of a couple of his films. Peckinpah's basic thesis. And it's really provocative. I've long wanted to show. I would love to just have a whole seminar just on Peckinpah. Peckinpah's thesis is stripped of the thin pretension of our ego. We are all undifferentiated beasts. Well, that's been a lifelong. He wants to really rub our face in that we are pretty pagan and we're pretty violent. And he wants to ripe that pretension we have that we are a good people. And he wants us to look at evil. That the evil is just poignant. It's just breathtaking. Right? His and this Liliana Caravani thing that I hope to show today from the Night Porter. But I think it's important we see that. I don't like it. I don't go to those on Friday nights. I'm too tired.
When you think about Peckinpah and you say what he wants, what he's saying about us, what's going to be that about himself?
Both. And do you remember last night, the only way I can answer that, John Beebe has revived Andrew Saras for the Jungian and analytic world. And I talked last night about Saras' three criteria of an auteur, a genuine author. You can tell that you're seeing an artist that has a real distinction as a filmmaker if you get a real sense of their technical expertise. They've mastered their craft. You really know Picasso, it looks simple to what he paints, but he's got tremendous craft in that. It's tremendous years of training and preparation went. He had those frenzies. I don't know if you've seen that documentary where he just goes in this pottery room and just creates in a frenzy, but it's a trained frenzy that's been developed across many decades. So the technical expertise, you have a strong sense of their personality. They're not afraid to be who they are and announce that. You get a sense of their stamp on the film. And the third, this I think identifies your question, they preserve that tension between really showing us something about their own unconscious in a fairly disclosing way. A non-embarrassed way. Beebe's thing about Alfred Hitchcock is that Beebe thinks Hitchcock's working, and I'm not sure about this, but Beebe's thing is Hitchcock's working on his negative mother complex across 52 films. And that was his whole life. And you see Hitchcock making work on his own incest damage with his own mother, his negative mother and the archetypal mother. And that he does it. Beebe's really touched by how Hitchcock spans that across he's seen all 52 films 7 or 8 times. He's seen the whole genre. And then he says, the reason Hitchcock walks onto all of his films, he wants to say to us, this is me, I want to be honest. I'm implicated by what I've done. He walked on all his films. He had a walk-on role. And I think that's true. But what Sarah says is, there needs to be the tension between knowing this is my unconscious process, but so that it doesn't get gratuitous, there's a respect there too for the collective condition of suffering that where I'm touched personally. I want to do this to not only help heal me, but I have out of my own pain, a sense of compassion for your pain. And I want to have that tension between the objective reality of what I'm bringing you and my own psychology and its impact. Well, I'm real touched by that. Because, folks, if you haven't figured that out, every analyst is getting, you're paying for our therapy every hour if you come and see a psychotherapist. If you're a psychotherapist, you know that. The only way that I preserve integrity and the only reason I feel I can even take a fee is I'm expected to preserve that tension, to know where my unconscious material gets stimulated, to not feel embarrassed about my countertransference, to use it. But always, the ethical thing is in the service of the dilemma that the client brought to me. I only use that material as best I can in the service of their growth and not my gratuitous kind of therapy. But I can't help it. The way I do therapy and the way Kate would do therapy is very different because of the different style that we work our unconscious, and the way our unconscious is present in the room. The way Jung did it, and the way Gordon does it, and the way that Sigmund Freud does it, it's different because of our unconscious. The only way it's ethical is if we try to be conscious to it. We supposedly have had our own analytic, we've had our own analysis so that it doesn't do harm to the patient. And we can actually use our wound in the service of the patient. That's the only reason I get paid a fee. And there's some days that I lose it, and every therapist has to confess that probably every great analysis, they've done something sadistic or abused a person unconsciously because the pressure is so great. Again, why we get paid for it is you're hopefully bright enough to feel ashamed about it, go to your colleagues, get some consultation, and heal the wound, and then confess it and heal it and move on. You cannot do it. And a great author, film author, cannot not sometimes just have something out of their own gratuitous self-growth on the screen. But they correct it. You can see them correct. They lose. You watch a film, and it seems a little off. The continuity drifts, and then it snaps back in focus. You could bet the director hit one of their complexes. Got lost a little bit, and snaps back into shape again. You know? You wonder how they miss some of these things. Some of the errors, the sequences or the dates, or it's 1980, and they've got 1940 cars in the background. And, things get missed. My guess is probably the director unconsciously left something about his 1914 or her 1914 incest wound. He left an image of it in the frame. Let me get to this. Cinema Paradiso. I just want to show this. Again, I want to relate Jungian psychology, cinema, and spirituality. It's this wonderful scene. We're just in the sacristy. The young boy, Toto, who is the film's narrative hero, who loves film, he's the altar boy, a reluctant altar boy, holding the candles, serving the Eucharist. We all know the church is dead now. Jung knew the church was dying, the institutional church, in the 20s and 30s. In the United States, the institutional churches have been dying in the 60s and 70s. Those sanctuaries don't hold a real sacrament anymore. It's spilling out in other places. Well, the kid acts out, he's ornery, and the priest gets angry at him, and the mass is kind of empty, and the kid knows it. The kid knows where the real mystery is, because after this is over, we're just seeing where the priest is taking off his robes, and he's going to go over to the Cinema Paradiso, where he is the censor. This is an Italian culture. And he sees the films before the local folks do and makes sure that the dangerous stuff is cut out. And Toto wants to go, and the priest wants to keep him away, but Toto knows where the real magic is. Kind of humorous vignette that I wanted to put in there. That's a wonderful part of the film works at many levels, and you see it, and I don't think it'll affect your enjoyment to just say, watch the relationship between Toto and Alfredo. Toto is a young boy, again, in a culture where the father's absent. He's over-involved with his mother. Mother's over-involved with him. But he's lucky enough. Robert Bly talks about we live in a culture where the men, because of the Industrial Revolution, and particularly since World War II, their work takes them farther and farther away for more and more time. So mother has to be both father enough and mother enough to her sons and daughters, and it's an impossible role. Fathers hate mother because she doesn't keep the family off his back when he comes home tired and exhausted at night, and sons and daughters hate mother because she's not father enough. Women get put in a real impossible bind that even Bly recognizes in the men's movement. It's an impossible bind. All of us have been put in this by this culture. This film, Alfredo, my experience is men get some initiation if they're lucky enough to have found a mentor. A father who looks in the soul of the boy and cares without any kind of selfish investment, just sees a special spirit in that boy and loves it into life. And Alfredo sees a spark inside Toto, and it's this wonderful anima flowering that happens inside the male anima, and the elder is passed on to the young man, and under the gaze of this mentor, he grows into a life of soul and spirit. It's a very touching scene. And the last thing he goes, the whole film is a series of retrospectives about him getting word as a famous producer. Toto now is a grown Italian producer. He's kind of a Carlo Ponti type, but compassionate. Gets a call in the middle of the night. Alfredo's died. He goes home, reconnects with his mother as an adult. It's some really touching scene. But Alfredo had left a gift for him. And it was this wonderful, it's very touching to see it. It's a canister, a cinema canister, and he shows it, and it's all these cut-out love scenes. And it's so touching just to see them. It's all there. And you see, again, it's the overt, it's Eros. And the priest loves it, but you could see those wonderful scenes. The priest's self-face of enjoyment, and then the ego would come. The superego, the ego would just come on his face, you know, and the profanation about how the sacrament has been turned into control instead of release and freedom. I mean, and then do you see where the film comes from? Where's it come from? The mouth of a dragon, the instincts, the unconscious. It's the dragons and gargoyles surrounding the surface at Shark. It's the instinctual live world of the demons and the thonic. And the self lives when we enter the world of the instinct. It's there. Everybody knows the power in Toto's childlike reverie. He's seeing the primal scene. I mean, it's really seeing the primal scene. Mom and Dad making love on the screen. He's in the curtain, and it has that. They're going to cinemas. These Lacan, the feminist and Lacan critiques too. So one of the things about film makes it kind of intriguing. It's a little bit it's a lot voyeuristic. You go in alone. It's like going in. We all wear trench coats metaphorically. We come in and hide our stuff. We sit in the back because we want to see forbidden things. Only we want to see Mom and Dad's love on the screen. We want to see a primal scene. And I think part of it is we want to get out of it. We want to believe that Mom and Dad can do their stuff directly instead of detouring it, and that human beings can have actual soul. And we're fascinated. We're looking through the keyhole into the primal bedroom. And that's that scene. And the priest, you know, the conscious religious world doesn't want us to look through the keyhole anymore. And of course, all of us are now in our culture saying baloney. We're all standing at the keyholes now. This is a giant, Jungian analysis is a giant peep show, and we're all paying $80 an hour to peep in the unconscious because we know that's where the real life is. We're no longer going to be denied a chance to come into the soul in a more conscious way. So it's a wonderful vignette.
The day that I saw that, I remember I was in the and I was really very, very sad because of what I thought was the separation between him and the woman, and someone in the back said, "Oh, you didn't see, you left too early." When they show the film, when we see the credits, it shows them coming together. Is that so?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well,
and I'm very happy that I'm so unknown.
Well, in my sense about that too is, you know, when I leave, you never know the intentions. That could work that's an unconscious conjunctio. The very fact of going home and returning to his mother as an adult and separated man, and returning to the grief of Alfredo and burying his mentor friend, he finally gets conjoined with that lost connection to his own inner. You never know whether that's an inner or outer event. It's one of those strange, but clearly it's a film about Jung. You know, Jung's whole interest, particularly from his heart attack on in the 40s, he was leading his whole career, but he writes his most brilliant stuff after the heart attack. He writes Ion in the late 40s, early 50s, and of course, I think the premier work for him was Mysteriones Communitionis, and that whole thing is incredible. You know, if you've read it, it's such a dense book, it almost overwhelms you, his knowledge of 11 languages, his knowledge of the alchemical material. But there, if you reread it, I've read it 3 times over again. You just have to sit with it and be stubborn with it. There are brilliant passages of soul in there. And the last chapter is the chapter on the conjunction between the masculine and the feminine, the coming home to our own soul. And I think Cinema Paradiso was a developmental story of the boy coming home to his own soul, transcending the loss, the ravage of the lost father, the poignance of the overly present mother, coming to terms with his own self through a male mentor and a love for the art and doing the art and working his... Clearly, he'd been working his individuation as a filmmaker. Because when he comes home, he's not arrogant. I'm real touched. He's a famous man. They call him Mr. Daviti or whatever. He says, "Come on, it's Toto. I used to work for you." And he sees the bourgeoisie out there behind. He goes, he looks a moment, he's touched, and he goes and holds hands with them. He has compassion. He's got compassio. It's a wonderful scene with his own mother, where he acknowledges and confesses his absence, and yet his mother reminds him it was really necessary. She's come to understand it was necessary that he was away, and that he comes, and that the real love is there. But there are a man and a woman, a mother and a son, who are two adults, and no longer caught in that kind of murky unconscious. They're their own people, living and fleshed in their own suffering with their own soul and their own conjunction. It's very touching. It works individually, and it works as family therapy. I was very touched. All of us, I think. I didn't mean to get into this, but it was kind of a side thing. I believe no analysis is over. One of my big, looks like maybe we need to take a break. I'm hearing just one of my big challenges with family, with union analysis, is that I do not believe analysis is over. I don't let any patients out now without strongly encouraging them towards the middle or end, because I think it takes this long, to bring in their living parents and brothers and sisters one at a time for a consultation as a way to finally break this incest bond and to really have the courage to tell the truth to one's parents. And those sessions are so incredibly touching, to see adult people in their 30s and 40s terrified of bringing their mother in into their analysis. I mean, you know, there's this kind of terror. You don't understand. You may have done this with everybody else, but you don't know my father or you don't know my mother. They will be upset or something awful will happen and here I can never get them here. And they come, and usually I work on Friday, and then for an hour and a half, I have the client kind of reveal their pain and then ask some questions, ask their parents questions about easy things like, Mom or Dad, how did you handle sexual dysfunction in your life? I'm kind of impotent or non-orgasmic these days in midlife, and I'm feeling a lot of pain. Have you ever had that kind of trouble, and what did you do about it? Mom, Dad, I'm failing at my career. I feel stupid and dumb. Nobody knows it yet, but I'm afraid they're going to fire me, and I don't think I know diddly, and I'm embarrassed and ashamed. Did you ever feel out of steam, and how did you stay alive? You're a generation older than me. Mom, Dad, I realize that I've never really loved my husband or wife. I've expected them to heal the wound with my own mother or father, and I really longed for you, and I still carry that. And do you still long for your mother or father? And how did you ever put it to rest? How do you get unhooked so I can really be with the real person I should be loving more fully in my life? How did you do it? Or how did you suffer it through? And I'm really scared to death of dying. I realize that at some kind of level, the thing I fear the most is my own death and dying, having a meaningless existence. You're a generation older than me. How are you getting ready for your death? What do you think about your death? Ask those questions in an hour and a half, kind of easy. Sharing open consultations. 2 days over the weekend, then an hour and a half on a Monday. And we'll repeat it if it's necessary. The incredible, I've been real touched about the dreams that these people have over the weekend. Dreams of letting each other go. Very much like Toto and his mother in his film, and arriving back with each other in a more adult and realistic and that poignant, sorrowful stance. There's always sorrow when we're individuated. There's this sense of all that we suffered. And yet there's a sad sweetness in Toto when he stands in this crowd. The Cinema Paradiso is being blown up. It's an anachronism. They're going to blow it up. It's this old cinema. And all of the crowd stands there. And this building is demolished, and the dust flows over the onlookers. And the grief and the sadness, this loss of this one last temple and vessel for community, and their awareness of what a great loss it is in their town. It's a very touching film, so I encourage you to see it. Take a break. Spiral dance. As I said, I believe all of us have an original experience. Most of us lucky, it happens 18 to 36 months. Most of us are garden variety neurotics. I doubt there's anybody in this room that's escaped wounding from 18 to 36 months. Our parents just don't have enough consciousness to hold. But we all have an original experience of what I call primal wounding. And what it is, what this wound is, the French are real interested in this work called looking, and we're going to see a lot of, you've seen images about the look, the primal look, the baby looking in the parents' eyes. We are born in utero, and what we absolutely need is for the mother and the father to look at us with unconditional love and a vow to protect us from all danger. Well, that's an inhuman vow, an inhuman expectation. It can't be done, but that's what we expect. And it works a lot of times. We all had experiences of children and clients or recovered our own childhood. That look is there. That precious, unconditional look of absolute divine presence in the you were absolutely adorable, and I love you beyond all things, and I will let no harm come to you. The mirror gets set up. I am the absolutely good mirror. You see yourself through me, and it's perfect, and you are beautiful, and anything you want is yours. Well, in our culture, you've got a parent doing that, and the parent's also got to work, and probably a two-parent work. You've got a crazy center.
We had some trouble with the mic here, but now we'll resume with Terry Gibson.
Oh, thank you. But there's the primal wound. And then I experience what happens. We crystallize it. You know what crystallization means? We have to get away from it and deny it and turn it off. And the mechanism is real interesting about what happens. We're pretty clear about that. Basically, when mother or father fail us and they get angry and we pick up the message, if we don't show it up, they might do something bad to us. We eat that tear. The technical, we're Freudian and Jungian psychology meeting in object relations and in Lacan and Melanie Klein, and her word for that is an introjection. We eat that. And what we've discovered we do with what we've eaten, that negative stuff, is we split it off. We bury it unconsciously. Particularly the bad mother or father gets split off, the bad breast and the bad penis get split off. And hear me now, the feminist rereading as I'm reading it, and I think the correct way, we're getting some new early life research. Mother and father have a pretty tandem and parallel impact on early life development psychologically. But the bad penis and the bad breast get split off. We just can't handle it. And we remember only the good breast and the good penis, and it's only a partial image of the, but that's the only part we can cope with. And this terrifying stuff lives in us as an introject. It's like acid, but it gets sealed, and it's like those little things in the bottom of the mothership in Alien. They're waiting to grab ego in the face one day when we make the mistake of going down there someday when we're stressed or overworked, and one of those things gets us and we go crazy. That stuff's in us. Just get a feeling of the power of that. It crystallizes as an introject. This lives in there. And we, the fantasy is, it's not there anymore. We're okay. Then there is a ceaseless search after this. We still remember the anxiety in our behavior. It's almost reflexive. There's a ceaseless search for a safe place to dump these toxic, corrosive wastes and re-experience the respectful, adoring treatment one primarily deserved. In our culture, we call that process dating. I want you to hear that. It is called dating and marriage. It ends up in marriage. But the beginning look, and realize, I have an interesting theory, and I'm not being cute here. When I have couples come in therapy now, I believe couples in the first 30 seconds unload in the whole negotiation. I want you to, any lover that has been primarily important to you, your first lover, remember your first moment of meeting them. I have couples try to, and I want to get back to the first 30 seconds. We are incredibly, the whole deal gets worked out. I remember meeting my wife in a basement at Jones Hall at the University of Kansas. It all got loaded in 30 seconds through the look. Through the look. Oh my God, I have finally met a non-hysterical, abundant earth mother woman who will see all of my graciousness and my strength and my intelligence, will love me and mother me in a perfect and absolute way to which I wished I could have grown accustomed, and will heal and carry me to death with a royal warrior style, and will be my adoring spouse forever. And Rosie looked at me and said, oh my God, I finally met a man who understands and is strong and is not my alcoholic abusive father and knows his own self and is poetic and he's an Adonis and will love me and nurture me and see my grace and creativity and will see me as an equal and will adore me and love me and see the sleeping beauty in me and take me to my death and my pyre of soul with purity and decency of heart at last. Locked in. Now, that's the conscious part. I want you to carry that bitch and that son of a bitch for me and act them out for me when we get under tension and let me believe it's all in you and I have nothing to do with it, so I can scapegoat you. And she did the same thing with me. But it's all loaded up. Ceaseless search. We transfer these wastes and these remedial. We want the expectation is we'll heal, we'll repair the damage, and that's called projection. I just mirrored or modeled for you what the projections are. They are real. Jung believed projections are everywhere. Jung said we project this split-off stuff into the other person. And Jung always said, remember, please, that the projection is a wonderful collusive process. There can be no projection if there's not a hook. We also ask for what we get in this world. It just doesn't. There's no such thing as innocence. We want to believe, you know, have a bad day. Why did this happen to me? Well, I woke up with hooks hanging out all over me. He says, abuse me. This is my day, you know. I'm unconscious. Come grab me. The activating of these transferred contents for the purpose of study and reassurance, Kleinian word, key in Jungian psychology now, projective identification. What that is I unload all this negative stuff in my wife, and I say, now I want you to scream and act crazy like my mother. And then I can say, I remarried my mother. All these women are crazy. This is nuts. But I also do it. It's not just negative. I really want to figure out a way to study it to see if I can understand why this keeps happening. And the interesting thing is, I control the process. I think you blow up on your own, but I push your buttons. I decide when I want to have another lesson. And I do it over and over and over. You get couples in, and they have these incessant fights. It's wonderful to watch the masters and mistresses. They've come at touching each other's projective identifying button. Now, what Klein, the brilliant thing Klein added in this projective identification process, and it's all about the incest wound. I really get married to try and unhook from my mother to meet the real other who's a peer. But we never get that. Most of the time, people regress, and they're really marrying their mothers and fathers. That's really true. And it's an unfinished incest work. The real brilliant is an analysis. And I think you can have it individually. I think couples can have analysis. I think families can have analysis. I think it'll work, depending, you can pick your container. It'll affect all those relationships anyway. The real beauty, if it worked, Klein added, she said, in projective identification, and in therapy what happens is you project onto the therapist, you unload all the negative stuff, you try to get the therapist to act it out. What happens, if the therapist can hold, is the therapist doesn't play the old game, doesn't get reactive, and mirrors it back in a gentle, compassionate way. The whole goal is, when you're done studying, if you can have the courage to take that back in, take your projection back, pull it back, and trace it to its introjected source and say, oh my God, that's in me, and I've been carrying it all these years. And you can transform it. It's what Jung called the shadow. Most shadow is introject. The personal part of the shadow is that introjected, split off, incestuous toxins. I don't know how it happened for you. I can tell you how it happens in families, how the incestuous part came. I was the oldest child, born 1946 after World War II, of a famous jazz musician, used to play with Kenton and Woody Herman, was on the road a lot, was in the Army, they drafted all the Army bands, and my mother was a talented concert pianist, was working her way up in the regional competitions towards national stuff. When the war came and they got married, in patriarchy, my mother had to give up her career and birth children. I think she felt a lot of rage about that, understandable rage. It's some unconscious, they split off from the rage about that, the bad part split off. I'm going to be a mother, isn't that great? God, I'm angry about giving up my career. I mean, that could split up. And then she stuck with his son. She wasn't nurtured very well, was abused by her father as a child. My dad, anxious about this, does what patriarchs do when they get anxious about intimacy. He figured out a way to be on the road even more. He signed up with bands that weren't on the road 6 months. They were on the road 9 months. And what happened was, I was the only man in the world. And at some literal and symbolic level, my mother said, I can't trust that son of a bitch, your father. They're jerks. Men all run away. But you are my son. You will love me as purely and ideally and will soothe me and nurture my sadness forever and ever and will never betray your dear old mother. And that was the deal we locked in. And so my mother and I have been ganging up against my father for 45 years. And the rule was, my dad and I should never get together to unhook and tell the truth about men-to-men stuff, about that pain. It took me 1980. I got the idea of going back to Highway, Kentucky, where my grandfather killed a man in a card game. And it was in Hatfield-McCoy country. They got him out of town so a feud wouldn't happen. No male in my family has ever returned to Highway, Kentucky. Another myth in our family is that all males died in their 50s from violence or alcohol. And so I said to my dad, who was 61 and the oldest male we knew, I said, Dad, why don't you and I go back to Highway on a trip? See what we can find out about our ancestors. I asked that in 1981. Every time I raised that with my dad, my mother could be 20 miles across Kansas City at a music sorority meeting, and she'd be there in 2 minutes saying, can I go too? The triangle would get split up. She was afraid that we'd get together and she'd be left out. That's the way triangles work in family. Took me 9 years to get my father to Highway. Finally, what I did is I did a Jung Society presentation in Nashville. I bought his ticket. Sent it to him and said, I'll pick you up at 2 o'clock on Sunday. There was no way out. Because you can't. And one of the Bible Belt ethics is, if somebody buys something for you, you got to use it. So figured out this deal. Met my father. We stayed in motels and talked about the same stuff I shared with you. I heard confessions of my father about childhood abuse, family incest secrets, the pain that he'd carried alone for years. My father told me about his affairs. I thought I'd had an illegitimate half-sibling for years that had been a myth, and my father and I could talk openly about that and discovered that wasn't true because I had a half-brother and wanted to meet him. My father and I went back to Highway and found 18 Gibsons who'd wondered what had happened to our branch of the family. Six of them were men over 90 years of age, which is very reassuring. Found the graves of the great-great-great-grandfather that came from Scotland, the grandmother that birthed our family. The house that he built still exists on a thing called Gibson Hollow. My dad and I walked in that building with a Sears aluminum siding now, but they took us to the attic and showed us the old cross-cut wood saw. My dad and I burst into tears entering that structure. And then driving the twilight, all these confessional secrets between fathers and son. And after the trip, I felt closer to my mother instead of more distant from her, paradoxically, but in a more individuated way. But I'd been trying to get Rosa Beth, my wife, to do that work for me for years. And that's what happens in marriages. I was starting to take the projections back and work my own material. But it's hard. And then reabsorption and transcendence of these projections, and we call that transformation. A Jungian way that you could look at this, I don't know how many of you know Laura Dodson. She's a Jungian analyst in Denver. She's a wonderful woman. Presents occasionally here. She's like me, interested in family therapy and Jungian psychology. Laura uses this model to talk about the same thing I'm talking. I won't want to go in full detail, but you see where it says wounding? About 1 o'clock. That's the wounding I'm talking about, the primal wounding around our birth, first 18 months of life. There's a sense during that wounding we experience the abandonment and dismemberment that all of us have been wounded by. Then we need to re-enter that wound beyond blame and have a numinous experience. Most of us don't do that till midlife. When we start developing symptoms, we get phobias or anxiety attacks, or we have nightmares. Most of us can put it off till 35 or 40. But we have the unconscious calls, and we can't put it off anymore. We've got... Jung borrowed that word from Rudolf Otto, was a theologian, wrote a book called The Idea of the Holy at the turn of the century. Otto said, he talked about the holy, this experience of the divine, feels holy, and he said it has a tremendous and fascinating effect that is numinous. It's the sense of the aura, the pneuma, of the divine in our presence, animated and alive. It's the sense, it's not every day we are with the self. The same sense of that Virgil lying cruciformed, and he's about ready to face his death, and then the lights appear, and there's this numinous look in his eye. It's a sense of being in the presence of the transcendent that's also everyday and imminent. If you haven't had those moments, your life still has a power to come. What Jung recovered for us is that I believe that the numinous is the normal way of existence. We are so frightened about it that we flatten everything into the everyday. The numinous is in our midst all the time. It's here today. The numinous is in my marriage. It's in my work. It's when I'm driving my car. It's with all of you. It's in this film. But we're so terrified. Ego only lets it in little doses. It's a wonderful drug. And ego just afraid it can't handle too much all at once.
In the film, when he says, "I see light all around me," and then he's hallucinating
back. Yeah. Oh, sure. Yeah. Wonderful. Flatten it right up.
Yeah.
Discount it right away. Flatten it right up. Yeah. Don't want to believe that. And Jung's whole fact, and Jung got empirical about it. Jung got interested in synchronistic experiences that constellates the number. A causally related events that happen in our life with great meaning. Things that aren't spatially and temporally related suddenly are side by side, and you can't deny the connection. You may have heard the story. Jung got inflated. He was doing couple work. He was matching people's astrological signs. He had some kind of theory about astrological signs and synchronistic experience, and he did data banks, and he wrote this paper, sent it off to the publisher, and the publisher sent it back and said, "Carl, we don't understand. All of the columns don't add up right." And presumably, he swore in Switzerdeutsch, a blue streak, and threw the paper all over his office and stomped around like a little kid. Never tried to do it again. He was trying to flatten and make objective a synchronistic experience that comes from the deep. You never can explain that logically and rationally. It's the irrational world joining the rational world, and holism's created. So there's a reentry, and generally most people are called by a numinous experience. It's experience. Usually our pain, some great pain, opens up a possibility for great opportunity, and it is numinous. There's defense to deal with the pain. We deny to restore the old order. This numinous is so frightening to us that we have to cut it off. we project again, we make our wives and kids carry all this pain. Sometimes we do it with even more of a vengeance. We have to recover humility, awareness of our common humanity and suffering. We have to forgive ourselves, and then we have to forgive others. We have to reconnect with a deep self-like virtue. And did you see all of these? As he was descending, you could see him getting more humble. You could see him forgiving himself and seeing words of love to her, and she was forgiving herself. He was descending with this whole process, this newness process. You need to practice that over and over. You need to remember the humility. We all get inflated and want to deny and cut it off, and then a sense of wholeness comes. And life is, this doesn't happen once. Going through analysis won't solve it for you. There's a lot of analysts that get inflated and think, well, I've arrived. Once I become an analyst, I'm a member of the club. I'm convinced we go crazy at regular intervals our whole life. And it's a spiral about remembering the humility of our common humanity over and over again as we drop towards the deep part of the self. But that is Lord Dodson's way of seeing how this process works across the life cycle. Just quickly, the way I see it across, we're born with a native innocence. Eric Neumann called the Ouroboros, the snake that bites its tail. We're born undifferentiated, but we're these primal innocent, it's a naive innocence, this unconscious perfect being. It's those diapered adult babies and the mothership and alien. You know, that's the Ouroboros. Then we have the primal wounding. We split it into all good and all bad. We project the all good and all bad in anything handy, our parents, our kids, our spouses, whoever we can find that's willing to play the game with us. Survival is forgetting it at all costs. Then we have kids. We go through our own childhood. Then we go into adulthood. And we usually meet a spouse, and we project all the negative stuff into our spouse. And then we figure out that the spouse can handle only so much, and we project it into the kids and carry it forward. Then we have a midlife aging, and this is where it reappears. The crisis of self comes. We remember the past wound. Suddenly we remember the pain. That split-off stuff races up at us in our dreams, and we get symptoms. We split again. We project again. We deny again. And eventually we realize we get exhausted, and the self really dies. Virgil just lays cruciform. He finally has to surrender humbly to his own state of woundedness. And then at that moment, sorrow comes, and there's a conscious recovery of lost innocence. And hopefully we there begin individuating Jung's thing about how to ensoul ourselves across the life process. And if we're lucky, that really works. If we're not, it doesn't. But that's the process. Had a guy, one of my favorite examples of this midlife crisis, show you how simple it shows up. A couple of years ago, I had a stockbroker come into therapy. The presenting symptom was he was in a Chinese restaurant one day. He suddenly choked. Somebody knew the Heimlich technique, or he would have choked to death on the food. Being a man who knew how to flatten numinous, because it really wasn't numinous. He faced his death and was frightening, but it was fascinating to him. He said, well, I just won't eat Chinese at lunch anymore. That's the problem. You flatten the experience. That's what we all do. I just want to eat Chinese at lunch. MSG.
I know a lot of middle-aged men that have gone out and divorced their wives and go back and marry a 15, 20 younger woman.
Sure.
Have a family all over.
Sure.
Stay away from it.
Sure. Just flatten it right up. You know, it's just this woman. She's a she-devil. Which bitch? I'll get somebody, or the bastard that I married, I'll find somebody else. You know, just find it. It's a wrong. I got the wrong man. I got a defective man or woman. I'll just find another man or woman. It'll be okay. We flatten it out. Well, this guy, he thought it was MSG, and then by the time he came to me, he tried all the restaurants and had the same symptom, developed in the elevators, and by the time he came to me, he could only be symptom free in his front room at home, and they had to arrange the couch so he could sleep there in his office, and his wife had to drive him to and from work. And the Freudians would call it globus hystericus. So he had an actual swelling of the hysterical, anxiety-driven swelling of the glands in his throat. So we decided to work, and I think probably death. I had a sense that this was the appearance of the split-off material. It was the pods that it got, and I didn't know what it was. He denied it, but it was literally entering his mouth and choking him. It was the bad phallus crammed down his throat. So I just sat with it. About 3 weeks in, he had a dream, and in amplifying the dream, he went pale. He went pale. He says, oh my God. I said, what happened? He says, well, I just remembered my son just went through confirmation in the Roman Catholic Church the week before I went to the restaurant and had the symptom. And then he went pale and started to shake and started to cry. I said, what are you noticing, Jack? What are you feeling? He says, my God, when I was 13, my father took me because it was the first time he caught me kissing a girl out behind the house. And saw it. My father was so enraged by that he took me and rubbed my neck and side of my face on the hot stove. And he turned and he still had a scar there. Still had a scar. And it was on the eve of my confirmation. Anniversary events, often the split-off material, when his own child, he fathered as far as he had conscious safety to father. And of course, I'm sure his kid's carrying that split-off, multi-generationally, hands-on, generation to generation. But this father now found it, and the analysis then really went to work. It's that simple, and that powerful, and that profound, and that unavoidable. Now, quick, what time is it? Oh, it is. Darn it. Well, we'll come back at 2. I want you to kind of, people wanted this, and we're going to show a film vignette out of The Night Porter. And we'll look you will see in Technicolor the power and fascination and revulsion of incestuous imagery and reality in our lives. It's a tough sequence to observe. So, Eat a good lunch, but don't eat so much you'll go to sleep. You know, this is one of our ways to avoid this stuff.
There's one thing I want to mention. I don't know if anybody's interested, but on the front of this big building over here,
I think it's important. I don't think that I analyze films and I go. I think it's important to go to a film and have an experience, and then journal afterwards, and then go again if you want to be more analytic. It's like a dream. The Royal Road. The difference between Freud and Jung, and the primary thing is, you know, Jung said the royal way into this is through the complex and the feeling around it, where it grabs us and hurts us and wounds us and mangles us and inspires us. That's the entry into any experience of the psyche. And to let yourself have that experience. Don't be analytical about it. That's the sin of, that's the way patriarchy avoids getting, has hurt all of us as men and women. It flattens and objectifies and doesn't let us get into the deep psyche. It's just afraid of that. And we don't need to be afraid of it. But 3 questions you might ask. From the minute it rolls, hypothesis, there will always be a statement about where ego is. The center of consciousness in ego in his or her womb. Somewhere, the camera will establish a point of view where ego is. There will be a statement about where the self is. Usually, the ego is out of touch with the self, and this film is about getting a reestablished relationship with the self. And there'll be a lot of data almost immediately about where the self is or is not. And there will be a statement about what the disturbance, the complex, the interruption is between ego and self. Very early, that's established in the first minutes of the film. Almost invariably, that's Gibson's hypothesis. You can try it and write me if it doesn't work. I find it works most of the time with most of the films that I experience. Within the 2 or 3 minutes, these 3 things are established and provide the frame for us to go through the experience.
A lot of films start with coming down.
What flashes immediately into mind is Hitchcock's Psycho, if you can remember it. Eagle Eye, establishment shot of Phoenix, a kind of wilderness around, way up in the sky. I think it was Phoenix, I remember. I'm trying to remember what the opening city. And then the camera zooms down, and it's a funny angle, and goes in. We're voyeurs immediately. The way Hitchcock gets us to be voyeurs, and gets us looking immediately, we're looking in the bedroom at shadowy lovers on the bedstand. And we just, and we're there. I mean, Hitchcock, the master auteur, John Ford, for those of you who are last night with the Searchers, immediately, we know where ego is, we know where the self is, and we know the disturbance. We get zoomed in on Ethan and where he's lost between the self and the ego real quick. The brilliant masters and mistresses of cinema know how to do that. I'm not going to start because I decided it's so brutal. We'll ease in. We'll look at 3 visions, most of kind of an incestuous way wound. They'll get increasingly provocative. First one, we've talked about the look, I've talked about the importance of that early look, the early maternal, paternal, infant look, the adoring. I want you to have a brief vignette here from, I love this film. Sometimes I just get excited. I just love this film. And I'm going to show you this vignette, and I hope before the end of the day I can show a full sequence. It's Carla Suarez's Carmen. It's a flamenco version of the opera. And it's just a wonderful look at anima and ego relations. But I'm going to show you a little vignette about the look, the attempt to reestablish a healing look. And this little vignette, you'll see projections and interjections. You'll sense the wound. I want you to look at it. We'll talk about it a bit. But this happens about 12, 15 minutes into the film. The whole film is about a director in a urbane Spanish environment who wants to do a flamenco version of Carmen, and it's one of these play within a play, and, you know, mirror within a mirror, and film's already a mirror, so it's multiple mirrors. And it's about his look for the right woman to do Carmen, and he finds the right woman, who's this kind of late adolescent, early adult, languid Lolita, Spanish Lolita-like character that's full of eros and hardness, all mixed up, softness and hardness, absence and presence, all wrapped up in the same woman. You'll see the young director's, he has a woman who is she manages the actual instruction and choreography. And it opens with a scene with this older woman trying to break in this raw young recruit into the cast. Think about the model we were talking about just before lunch, how the model might work here. What did you, just a feeling level, let's do a feeling first. How did you feel watching it? What were you feeling? What's your body feel like watching? Just watching that little visual in there, how'd your body respond to that? Tension, what they feel, the tension. Between the two women and who else? Him and her, and him and the two women. He's got tension, different tensions with both the women, and they got tensions with you. Feel a tension. That's in your... Where is it in your body? It's interesting. Did you notice where you felt the tension? Up in the chest. Mm-hmm. So you feel that there is that. It's embodied tension. The tension of not fully conscious eros, probably. All circulating, dark, convoluted conflict and complex. Complex is there, and it's in his body.
There it is. Okay.
Cover the same ground and hopefully work it a little bit deeper. But I'm here to try and relate cinema, spirituality, and union psychology. And a kind of organizing theme that I've used is incest, which is real important to me clinically. And I've been thinking a lot about the importance Freud and Jung made to recovering a consciousness, both personally and archetypally, about how incest is an inescapable force in our lives and maybe the main engine that drives our psychological development. And today we're going to get into talking about looking at film images and reflection of this theme around war and peace, around male and female, and around what I call innocence and individuation. So hopefully by the end of the day we'll have had a chance to deepen and work it. But just read this quote. It was during Advent of the year 1913, December 12th, which is really interesting to me. It's the feast day of Our Lady of Guadalupe. He had no way to know that, but it's kind of an interesting day in the West. The only black Madonna we've got in the Western Hemisphere, the one day that she celebrated, is on December 12th. But you think last night about, we saw, those that were here, we saw The Searchers. And the one way I think to look at that film is that it's John Ford showing us how his unconscious got opened by Femian at the beginning of the film. And it was on a very feminine day, I think, that Jung in 1913 had this experience. That I resolved upon, he calls it the decisive step. He doesn't say a decisive step. He said, I decided on the decisive step. I was sitting at my desk once more, thinking over my fears. Then I let myself drop. Suddenly it was though the ground literally gave way beneath my feet and I plunged down into dark depths. I could not fend off a feeling of panic, but then abruptly, at not too great a depth, I landed on my feet in a soft, sticky mass. I felt great relief, although I was apparently in complete darkness. After a while, my eyes grew accustomed to the gloom, which was rather like a deep twilight. Before me was the entrance to a dark cave in which stood a dwarf with leathery skin, as if he were mummified. I squeezed passing through the narrow entrance and waded knee-deep through icy water to the other end of the cave, where on the projecting rock I saw a glowing red crystal. I grasped the stone, lifted it, and discovered a hollow underneath. At first I could make out nothing, but then I saw that there was running water. In it, a corpse floated by, a youth with blonde hair and a wound in the head. He was followed by a gigantic black scarab and then by a red newborn sun rising out of the depths of the water. Dazzled by the light, I wanted to replace the stone upon the opening, but then a fluid welled out. It was blood. A thick jet of it leaped up, and I felt nauseated. It seemed to me that the blood continued to spurt for an unendurably long time. At last it ceased, and the vision came to an end. Last night we saw somebody who decided to drop into the unconscious inside a spaceship and met all sorts of strange and wonderful, bizarre images. Here's another image of dropping for a fairly recent film called The Abyss, which is kind of interesting. You just think about the title of it and popular fascination with it. So near the end of the film, those of you who saw it, it's about an underwater scientific exploration team in deep underwater. It's kind of interesting, though, all these things about going to extreme environments, either extreme outer space, where we were last night with Alien, or extreme depths of the sea, as we are in this film, a deep unconscious. And the dicey tension here is a former man and wife, masculine and feminine, that couldn't work their stuff. There's a lot of warring and sparring going on between, a lot of mutual projection. All sorts of, anybody that's had intensive love affairs could feel right at home with this couple, the kind of barbs that pass back and forth. But as the film goes on, it becomes increasingly clear that they're in danger. There's all sorts of threats in the outer environment. And where the scene opens, they've lost some equipment, and they need to make recontact. One of the crew persons has agreed to go to depths that no human has ever gone before. Interesting metaphor. A human has agreed to drop to depths that nobody's ever dropped to before in the sea. You think about Jung here. In fact, it's so deep that the device the filmmakers use is that this person, they fill the suit with water, and it's oxygenated water. This person has to learn to breathe the water in, as when we were in utero. It's a real interesting regressive metaphor. Go back in utero, breathe this oxygenated water. And there's some kind of panic, and then they tell him, just breathe naturally. You'll remember how to do it. You did it once as a fetus, and he panics, and they get him in the suit, and he's done it. And then just as the segment opens, he's about ready to drop to kind of recover this equipment that could save their lives and get them reconnected with the surface. He needs to go down to go up. Interesting kind of metaphors again. But this is the open. This is the filmmaker's vision of what this person has to encounter. What do you think about that? Before we might talk a little bit about it, just your reactions to that little vignette. Contemporary. Talking in the dark, is this fine? Because we'll be going back to another film thing.
Yeah.
There's enough outside light. What do you notice? What are you feeling? Yeah. What was upsetting about us as an audience? What got upset in you? What'd you feel like? And what would be your emotional state that you experienced about this? Sorrow. This vignette evokes a lot of sorrow. Pretty primal sorrow comes up. We'll talk about that primal sorrow in a minute. One of the powerful things about film is its immediate capacity to get us to identify with the point of view. And I think clearly the director's conscious and unconscious attempt was to precipitate the affect of sorrow. That was a predominant affect. Not horror. It's really interesting. Horrifying, of course. But sorrow comes out in a real deep, primal way. What other things did you experience as you watched the vignette? Oh, tremendous separation stuff. And yet something about the purposiveness and the necessity for separation. There's an interesting paradox. The terror of separation and the sorrow of it, and at some point the necessity for ego to step forward and say, I must separate, even if I know it's a one-way ticket. You know I had to come. It's an interesting message. But separation and loss, I think, part of our grief. A voluntary separation from that which is known and loved, even if it's conflict-ridden. And the whole, these two were competing. They'd had a previous deal where they were nearly dying. They were caught in a submerged canister, and they only had one air tank between them. And she proved that she was tougher than he was. She went without the air tank and died, and they had to try a new procedure to get her alive. She literally died, and they resuscitated her. And she volunteered for it. So it was this competitive It was this all this way that in marriage the conflicts and complexes are projected and handed back and forth. You ever been in a tense love affair? But it's known and there's love even with all the intensity, and to step out into the unknown and the frightening and possible death. What other thing? What did you feel? Oh, yeah. Yeah. Very good. Two places that metaphor came up. Where was the other place? Excellent. There's a tremendous sense of birthing, a fetal reaction. The last descent. What kind of images did you see? Uterine, female. Yeah, they're kind of wombic kind of sense about that. Any other image? That I'm talking about babies and birthing. I love you, baby. Remember even the word. Bill Williford, some of you remember back when he was in town and talking, Bill had an affection for the blues. And one of the true things, he spent a lot of time listening to Lightning John Hopkins and Muddy Waters and listening to music. And one of the things he really felt is blues was a powerful whale, particularly for black males. Black females to regress back to primitive states of sorrow. And it was a functional regression about all of the trauma that they had suffered at the hands of a culture that split their families, both personally and collectively. And if you listen to it, all the blues lyrics, I love you, mama, child. Mama, don't you cry, I'm coming home soon. If you ever listen to blues lyrics, it has a very regressive, sorrowful state about it. It's the sadness of the infant that's dying and a longing and a yearning for rebirth. So lots of that. Really, this was a regressive journey, I think. A powerful regressive journey that Virgil was taking. What other kinds of things did you feel? Noted.
One of the things that impressed me was at the moment of total sacrifice,
giving up the great
things.
Yeah.
And I think that is very much important.
I was not joking during the film. I said that really is the analytic task of any of you ever been. We all face analysis whether we volunteer for it or life forces it on us. Generally, life forces on us. Most of us are not bright enough to take it on our own. And there is that sense where you, at some point the ego knows it has to jump into the unconscious on its own will and volition. Thing like Inanna, the kind of the goddess of the light, has to twist like a rotten piece of meat, like Erish Kegel. There is a crucifixion metaphor. And again, yeah, spread out. And as a male, we were talking last night, we'll talk today about male and female, but one of the things you need to know is that I think film is still pretty much caught in patriarchy. 99% of the directors are male. I'm going to be very tentative about presuming to know anything about female initiation rites. I don't think we know a lot as a culture. I think we're recovering. I don't think we know much. We know a lot about them. I think this is a male descent fantasy in this film. I think we co-participate in it. I'm not convinced, as an analyst that works with women, that women's experience often parallels this. But there are, we can go back to some of these more matriarchal myths, and there do seem to be some kind of parallel. Yeah, there are some parallels. And there is that kind of crucifixion, it's very blatant. Two places where the crucifixion sign showed up. Both him laying on the rock, do you remember the other? See one of the crew people in the background? How dense these scenes are. A crew person crosses. Crucifixion symbols show up there. And of course, what Jung said, the cross is a symbol for what? In the archetypal realm, what is a cross a symbol of? Well, it's a quaternity, and it's a symbol for the self, isn't it? It's a cipher for the self, the deep soul-carrying part of the unconscious. And think clearly what we want. What gets constellated here at the bottom? What does this man see in his moment of death? What gets constellated before his very eyes? What appears to him?
You know what? This is really odd that creature reminded me of Tinkerbell.
Yeah, and Peter Pan.
Peter Pan.
And again, a very fetal-looking creature if you look at it. And what was the key thing about the creature? What was the key place of contact? And we're going to talk a little bit about that with the Lacanian analysis of film these days. What was the key place of contact between the creature and the man? Well, a hand. Hand was one place. And what was the other? The eye. I want you to think, we're going to talk about look and glance today. There's a deep glance. It is a deep, if you looked at that, there is a deep maternal, paternal glance of deep reverie and reverence and love. It is mommy and daddy. And angels. Yeah, angels of life and death. Creatures, wonderful, kind of a chrysalis. A butterfly is a symbol of a creature that goes through a remarkable metamorphosis from one state to another. So there's an image, and Jung said one of the key alchemical metaphors is the chrysalis that unforms and it brings a soul. And you have to nurture that chrysalis, and you have to suffer it through and suffer its life. But the chrysalis unfolds from its ugly cocoon. It becomes this transformed creature.
At one point where the creature
Well, and also have no society. That's really nice. You're on your own. But what do you get a rhythm in there? What kind of rhythm do you kind of hear in that?
Heartbeat.
You get an interuterine kind of thing about that too, don't you? And there was clearly umbilicus kind of symbolism in there. There were these regressive metaphors that show up all through this vignette. What about when he goes over the edge and he sees this? What is this thing he sees? What is it? When he follows it and he sees this, goes over the edge, and then there's this what? Well, it's a tunnel. It's like a city. I mean, you have city projections. And I want you, if you've ever read medieval alchemical and mystical texts, they talk about the New Jerusalem. Deep in the unconscious, they talk about the holy city. Jung talks about one of the most pure images of the self constellating in the West is the image of the New Jerusalem laid out in a quaternity. East Gate, West Gate, North Gate, South Gate. It's a city of perfect proportions. And the center is the Temple Mount. This very common image. And if you've been to Jerusalem, you know there's tremendous tension because two faiths now are at war about that central metaphor, which is the Holy Mount. It used to be that the Solomon's Temple was on the top of that mount now. And, of course, in the subsequent waves of conquer and conquest, the Islamic faith took over in the 8th century. And now the Mosque of Omar is there. And in that, if you've ever been in that building, the top of that mountain in the middle of Jerusalem, the holy mountain in the center of this holy city, is just a giant slab of rock. On that rock to the Jews is the fabled place where Abram offered up Jacob in sacrifice. You remember that story? And for the Mohammedans, for Islam, it's the place where Muhammad sprung alive bodily into heaven from that very rock. Talk about warring constellations. And they haven't figured out that maybe there could be room for both constellations. You know, that's the sad thing in our world. Christians would like to have their share of that too. Their crucifixion happened just on the slope of that, Golgotha. And they're not fighting over the very top because their holy shrine's a little bit farther away. Or they'd be in there too. We'd be in there too. But the self constellates. And why there's so much tension. And why it's terrible to see Israeli guards, 16, 17-year-old kids with Uzis walking around that holy place, fighting to claim the self for one perspective or the other than sharing. I mean, we're hopefully all moving to a global sense where we can understand that this preciousness and these constellations of soul belong to all of us. And they're equally precious. It's sad to me to see the ego fights around those sacred precincts. But I think this was a heavenly Jerusalem. This was what I want to get at. The self constellated for this man. And he was reborn. He faced his death, and it's a classic death and rebirth thing. It was his own analytic journey. And it's interesting, another thing, what do you think is up here? Remember, did you see a scene where he turns around and looks, and he looks at him, and he looks again? Who is that up in the shell? What is that up there? What are all these voices talking to him? What part of the psyche would that be? Personal unconscious, archetypal unconscious, ego? Where would you put that? Probably ego, wouldn't you think? He's all the techies talking to him. You know, the techies, tell him about... Yeah, yeah. It's the neurological ego condition part of our experience. Except, they're starting to talk techie to him, and then somebody says, she didn't use the word, she says, no, talk to him. Talk soul
before
to him.
That, they said, this man said, well, ask him about his
read the text about his body, and she immediately said,
translated.
How do you feel?
Early times when you're an analyst, you know, and you haven't figured out yet that you don't use words like interject and projection. I mean, it spells out to me, what in the world is I going to mean to a client? What does it really mean anyway? You'll learn to get down into your belly again. There's this kind of inflation that comes with science and technology in our culture. We really believe you learn something and know something. And you know, there's some real evidence that Jung went through a period of real arrogance in his career, and there was a certain point where he became much more human again. My guess is after he had a really near fatal heart attack in the 40s, and people say he was very humanized by that experience. Suddenly, his own mortality, he had more of an appreciation of Eros. And I'll talk more about that. I think he did some work on his own incest wound. If you remember, he had a fantasy about traveling around the world and meeting his father and going inside a sacred temple. There was a lot of reconnection with a lot of grief and sorrow that hadn't been resolved since his father had died of a stress-related illness prematurely early, and since his surrogate father, Sigmund Freud, died to him. I think Jung had to wait for a heart attack to start recovering some of his own grief. And they say he was a much more profoundly softer and more available and approachable human being. Can you imagine? He was probably pretty frightening. You know, this man that knew 11 languages, could speed read ancient Greek, and I mean, you know, fairly formidable kind of guy to hang around. I can imagine the projections he'd have. But something about his suffering and his own mortality humanized him. And I want to put a parallel. We now know what, you know, Jung was stupid, by the way. He was arrogant and stupid in 1913 when he dropped. Why would I say that? Well, he said he took this, I think it was hubris. And why was it pride-filled to do what he did in 1913, to drop in the unconscious? What mistake do you think? I think he made a grave error. We now discover that maybe he had more alone than we thought. But should you enter the unconscious alone? Well, he didn't. One of the ancient... Yeah. I think in our world, I think it's really dangerous to enter the unconscious alone. I really believe in communitas. There is a community, a caring community around us that knows the danger of that descent. And it's dangerous whenever you're feeling something strong and you're feeling like your world's falling apart. For God's sake, find some kind of community. An analyst is part of community. But I think we all need sacramental and liturgical communities of spirit to contain and hold us and talk to us in the descent. What's really interesting is that he had an ego container, he had a community, and he had this feminine figure to talk to him. And you could see her both as an internal symbolic figure and as a literal outer figure. We now know about Jung's descent. Was Jung really alone from 1913 to 1918? Have you heard the inside story about this? Well, we now really know he had an analyst. Tony Wolfe. Well, it's pretty clear that he had that feminine voice talking. A little corrupted. This was a former patient who was probably sexually involved with her. It was abuse. But he was not alone in that process. In my own sense is that Jung really learned about the anima from his experience, the terrible grief and the almost psychosis he suffered as a result of breaking from Freud, the second father figure. You know, he nearly went crazy. He tells us in Memories, Dreams, and Reflections, only three things kept him sane. He did that little children's village down by the lake, the relationship with his wife, and the relationship with his patients, the everyday real world. That's the only thing that kept him alive. The child, he played with the child in a regressed state, his love relationship with his wife, and Tony Wolfe. And I think he was in conflict about that, but I think both of them were loving him in different ways during that time. And his relationship with his patients, or he would have gone crazy. When I was 28 years of age, I was just finishing my training, and it was my second year of residency, and I met a woman who had been referred to me by my senior advisor, and they kind of liked what I was doing. I was a hotshot young male in the training clinic and had learned how to look like a hotshot. Young males in patriarchy, you learn to look like a meteor even if you don't feel like a meteor inside. You burn like it on the outside, so you get ahead in this world. And I was all persona fire, and apparently it worked. Inside I was scared and frightened, but they referred to me this woman who tried to kill herself 6 times with a butcher knife over the previous 3 or 4 years. She'd stabilized. She had a marriage therapist, and then working on that, she had a psychiatrist, and then she had an individual pastoral psychologist. And she had all these therapists, an armatorium of therapists, had pill bottles in all her pockets in her purse. I mean, she was a walking example of eclectic care in the early 70s. And they refer her to me to dilute the transference as kind of an exiting process for her to kind of wean off all these therapies because they felt she was stabilized. So I saw her, and the day I saw her, fate would have it. That morning she was brutally fired in front of all of her fellow colleagues from a job she'd had for 20 years. Kind of unpredictably, then brutally fired. So she comes into me in a state of complete ego disillusion. And I had just been to an NIMH conference on suicidology with a senior advisor down in Washington. At that time, it was the first national conference they had on suicide. The LA Suicide Prevention Center was in existence and had come and actually trying to share the research and what we knew about how to gauge lethality. And all scales, this woman was pretty toxic. I tried to get her to voluntarily hospitalize. And at that stage in my training, I couldn't, there was a part of me just couldn't get into this mandatory locking somebody. I mean, she was still available. Goddard did all of the kind of best crisis intervention stuff. What are you going to do a minute from now, 5 minutes from now? I gave her my number, in addition to all list of other numbers, psychiatrists and therapists. She had all these numbers to call. Kind of patched her together, worked with her an extra 45 minutes, told my senior advisor about it, and she called through all of those numbers all during the rest of the day. The next morning, she got up, was singing in the shower. Later, when we heard about it, it was horrifying. She worked with very depressed people. If they switch like that, that's one of the worst signs. Some of the theory is it's almost like they're relieved of the burden now of deciding. The decision's been made. She fed her family a huge breakfast. So it's this kind of passive-aggressive rage thing. I mean, feeding is almost a symbol of how much feeding they didn't get, I think. Fed her family and her husband this huge meal. Got in her car, drove to the Mystic River Bridge, paid her toll as a good citizen. Really interesting, the kind of way the ego drove right through the gate, parked on the side, and jumped 270 feet to her death in Boston Harbor. I'd never been that close to anything like that. My whole life was thrown into turmoil. And I can remember the only literature that I read over and over again that kept me sane was reading this chapter, Confrontation with the Unconscious. Reading about another male who had a lot of persona fire and burned out and his whole life thrown into smithereens. So Jung's suffering here is very real to me. And I think most males will tell you a story. I don't know women have, because women, I think, in a lot of ways are more affectively connected, just naturally in culture, than men because of the wound, the way we've differently been wounded by the culture. But there was something about that descent and Jung's description of it that meant a lot to me. And I watched Virgil's descent, and I have a lot of sense and parallel feeling about that. Let's move on. Let's just put this chart up again, we used this last night, but just for us to see Virgil and the gang up in the research vessel at a moderate level in the ego, doing science and techie stuff, and then danger comes, the personal unconscious threatens them. And, of course, there's also, we don't have time to look at the film, but there's all sorts of hidden metaphors and allusions to the, you know, really, this is, again, another film. People came to us and thought this was a science fiction film about the sea and the unconscious. And when you look at it, it's really about us. It's the way film is about psychological and spiritual processes. And when you watch the film, there's all sorts of personal conflict, and you see the personal childhood wounds of these people getting acted out inside this undersea ego container. Virgil drops through his own pain and recovers the sense of dearness. He regresses to a child. He sees mommy and daddy. He's able to say, I love you. And in fact, Robert Bly, for men and women who have been touched by Robert and Marion Woodman is a woman who I think is kind of Bly's companion in recovering depth experience. And Sylvia Brenton Pereira, when you talk about Descent to the Goddess. They'll almost universally, these men and women who work at that depth level, and all of us that are analysts, will tell you that the primary sign that the rigidities of the persona and ego and resistance to the deep unconscious, the primary expression is not rage and terror. I really believe those are derivative emotions. People need to rage and get terrified in analysis. But I know people are really regressed and are really facing the real soul issues of their life when there's this deep quality of grief and sorrow that begins to emerge in the process. That's hitting rock bottom. And we watch Virgil drop and we feel the sorrow coming up in our heart. We feel the mutual identification. We feel all of the loss and separation and death all of us have suffered in this world, the separation from our parents, the separation from the Elysian world of our childhood, all of the abuse we've suffered, the lost lovers that we've never been able to get past the conflict to tell them how much we love them and how dear they are to us, our own fear of our own death, and our yearning for connection with the Divine One and a meaningful place in the world. Virgil suffers all of this as he's dropping through the archetypal world, and he hits rock bottom. The Imago Dei, Jung calls out of the self. It constellates in this kind of holy city where he has this birthing experience, where he both dies and he rebirths, that sucking in the air with such a triumphal, it was full of pain. But dude, there's a sorrowful sense of ecstasy when you watch that. I mean, we want just feel the sense of life in his cry. So the model is there. Today, just to remind you what we're going to do, I was going to start with an opening theme vignette about transcendence and film, a Jungian model of what I call psychotheological experiencing and healing with cinema. And then we're going to talk about archetype and image, war and peace, men and women. We'll do part of that before lunch. Then this afternoon, I want to talk a little bit about how cinema might be seen as a form of spiritual direction. Have some ideas about how you might experience film as a way to mediate soul images. Finish talking about men and women, and then I want to talk a little bit about individuation and innocence at the tail end of the day. I wanted to show a brief vignette. Good, it's here. This is a recent film. I don't. If you didn't get a chance to see it, go see it in length. It's in the video stores now. It's a wonderful. It is an homage to film. It's very much like the Truffaut piece I showed last night. This one, though, this is a particular scene in this film, Cinema Paradiso. It is an homage to film and its effect on our culture. If you've not seen it, it is just wonderful. Even though it's about a small Italian village, it's about film experiences in Kansas City. It's about film experiences in New York. I mean, it's wonderful.
I just thought of it. I saw the Cinema Paradiso in the theater, and in the Italian version with the subtitles. Then they threw it on TV and then put it up. And the dub version lost.
Yeah.
Something that was lost. And I don't know why they insist on dubbing some movies when the subtitles and language behind the scenes.
Well, again, I think, when people were talking about that, I think, again, our culture gets frightened. We flatten the overt spiritual connotations of the cinemas. We talked last night about how the cinemas are much less, they feel much less temple-like in the actual structure than they did 20, 30 years ago. We talked about the gargoyles and the pillars. And our culture now, you go to cinemas and often they're long coffin-like boxes with carpeting halfway up the walls and linoleum floors and conditioned Dolby sound, fancy Dolby sound speakers. And another way to flatten the impact of film and its unconscious associations, you get a foreign film, if you take the language out, if you take the archetypal stimulus, the language itself, even if you don't understand the language, to hear it is an archetypal stimulus, you flatten some of its effect. And you put it on TV, and you put it in a, you frame it differently than you'd see it in a, it's all ways to reduce, I think, the spiritual impact. But the vignette, go see it, there's this, you know, one of my favorite scenes is it shows these people, this raucous crowd, watching this 1950s romantic potboiler. And people are yelling at the screen. There's a couple way back in a dark corner making love. There's another guy urinating and spitting off the balcony. I mean, it's all... And it's crazy. When I was a kid, John McKay was a buddy of mine, and they used to pay him to go and urinate off the balcony in the dark. It was all of that... it was a place to go and act out and do dark things when we were kids and yell at the screen and see John. You all were there. I mean, throw gumdrops down on people, spit on the audience, and then hide and see if anybody got upset. Spill your Coke on the folks. I mean, the balconies were the wonderfulest place. It's all in there. It's this raucous crowd. It's the wildness of the unconscious. People get in the dark, and it's kind of, it's Fasnacht, it's Fool's Night. And the unconscious has its play, both on the screen, and people are reacting with it. We don't react much anymore. It's very rarely. Only once in my whole life of seeing cinema, except for those childhood things, we were pretty raucous. But did I ever see an audience? Remember when I was in Boston in the early 70s, very much involved in the anti-war movement. I was politically and socially correct, been involved in civil rights stuff, gone to seminary. Same place where King got his doctorate and was taking all my classes from King. Walter Mueller had been his teacher in social ethics. And we were out in the streets and we went to Washington. We were really, Boston was, you know, 60,000 kids a night would get on the commons. And I mean, it was 1671 was an incredible cultural time. The unconscious was spilling in the streets. Well, a guy named Costa Gavras, you may remember, he does great State of Siege, one of his earliest films. He very provocative, overtly, politically angry films about the repressive aspects of materialism in the West. Pretty Marxist-looking thing, but Z. You may remember he did Z. I went in Boston, somebody was stupid enough to show Z in downtown Boston in that environment. The audience got so enraged they went over and turned two cars over and set them on fire. I've never seen it actually stimulate that much motoric unconscious in an audience. Audience surged out of the cinema, rolled over two cars and set them on fire. The effects were... And I've seen people applaud and hiss, and sometime today we'll look at a little vignette of The Grifters, which in my modern experience, I've never seen an audience leave in such abject disgust. People were breathing and spitting and heaving and sighing. It was a middle class, and they were just disgusted with this closing scene.
I used to live in Washington, D.C., and I've been in theaters where there was majority black audience, and that's a whole different experience, because they talk to the screen, and it's perfectly acceptable to carry on this long conversation with real angry.
And the black churches, it's speak and response. It's a wonderful kind of thing, you know. When you go in black churches, a pastor will say a line and the audience responds. Or when you sing, you line it out and then they respond. It's a wonderful, and I wish we would recover some of that spontaneity.
In Washington, there's a number of theaters that say talking out loud during the
news. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh,
I just wonder
if we don't need to talk to the television.
Well, sure.
I talk to those people at that hearing.
You son of a bitch! What? How could you not? Jesus Christ, I'm going to write a letter right away! Rosie and I were storming around, my wife and I. You bet.
The other thing that happens during services and back churches is or when someone responds, it's just your courage. I mean, when someone says, that's right, and encourage the person to go deeper into whatever, if it's singing, or somebody's ears off with a note, or if someone really, in a choir, really, their solo piece starts to really take off. I mean, I've heard people in the audience, here and there, just say, take it. There's all this support.
The improvisational and spontaneous expression of the depth psyche without judgment. Remember our word therapy. You know where the word therapy comes from. You know where it comes from. Where it first showed up and what it described. The transformational processes that happen at Eleusis, Delphi, and during the Mass. Christendom borrowed it as a description of what happens if you go through the full sequence of the Mass. There's a real healing. It's a confessional, a speaking out, an utterance, a bonding with community, a taking in a sacra, it's therapia. And the black church still has experience with the unconscious can have spontaneous utterances and can talk out and speak out and have validity and power and be embraced. It's a genuine confessional experience. Yeah, the boys in the hood, last summer, that was a real controversy. There were outbreaks of violence. My parents were, in New Jersey, my parents were visiting and my sister and I wanted to see it, so my parents went reluctantly along. But every once in a while, my parents were analyzing what percentage of the audience was black and what part of town they may have came from and whether they were in any danger. It was this constant scanning. And it was kind of interesting to go into a theater with a little sense of overt conscious danger associated with it. Of course, I never understood what provoked the violence. It's such a nice film. Was that what it was?
Yeah,
it wasn't actually the content of the film.
They haven't seen the film.
So it was not... Several last summer.
There was a black film that came out in South Africa about the man who was a hood, who was a street gangster, and how he made his own transformation. And he went to jail and he couldn't turn somebody in and had to own his own stuff. And I can't remember the name of it. It was kind of one of the long Guadini names. And in the audience, I was in Portland, and there was one black person in the whole audience.
Yeah.
It was played at the Grand Illusion for like a double week. These black things. It was interesting to see that.
And isn't it wonderful in a culture where black people are not given any permission to speak up and speak out? They have developed places where they can do that and utter some of their rage, and that's kind of spilling in the streets. And the cinemas of genuine art form becomes a place where that can happen, but they didn't show up in Portland. Because probably there was a little thing that said, no talking allowed during that.
I don't know if
going into the Ruby's restaurant and shot up all those people about a week or so ago. They found a stub on him of some serious official thing, and they said that what happened in that movie provoked him to do it. Did you see it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There's something in it about moving into a place and shooting it up.
Well, the whole film, the whole theme is about both stealing but getting back the Grail. It's really it's a analogy to the Grail myth. But I wouldn't see it provoking me. I see it really provoking the self and a connection to the deeper parts of the unconscious. Really, one of the central themes in the film is two naked men. So it's about a crazy street person, and a normal person discovers how crazy he is and joins with this person and gets in the world. But this is wonderful. The central theme for me in the film is the crazy guy, one of his favorite rituals is to strip down in Central Park at night in the midst of all of the thieves and robbers. It's a wonderful metaphor of getting naked in the midst of danger. And he lays in the grass and looks at the stars. And he tries to get this other guy to get, and the other guy's not going to strip his persona off quite that much. But this wonderful scene, this naked guy and this half-naked guy laying in the grass, and the naked guy tells him the story about, it's really the story of Anfortis, the wounded fisher king. The old king consciousness is wounded in the thigh and needs the younger male with real compassion in his eyes to come and say, what ails thee, my king, to really see the wound and to care about it. And in noticing a wound and having compassion, the thing I talked about last night, a suffering sense of the wound and putting aside his anger and his terror and his rage to just have a sense of sorrow. And that very moment, the wounded king and the young man both receive what they're in need of. The Grail Cup then becomes accessible to them. The self, the soul, becomes accessible. The real film is it's a modern retelling of the Grail story about how all of us yearn to find the Grail and transformation in the self. So, you know, unconsciously, I would not see the film to be a provocation to violence at all.
It's so crazy because I was watching a shot in the nightclub by the guy that came shot.
And see, that had nothing to do with the Fisher King. The Fisher King might have been an image to try to heal that kind of damage, but that was a literal...
That brought them
together.
Well, and the film, the one man who had lost his wife, but of course in the film, that film is about how that man went through a transformative suffering over the loss of his wife and recovered some sense of his soul.
Mm-hmm.
It's a film about a healing of that kind of act of violence. I mean, I don't see the film provocative consciously and consciously.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't know. He might have left the film at some point. May have not received the whole transformative impact of the film. Or the pain, he got just blocked. He saw that scene and couldn't handle it. But that's the power of image. I mean, I would never, even if that provocative stuff is there, I would never say, let's not show those images, even if they might result in some people misunderstanding them and literalizing the image. That happens all the time. You know, with film and therapy, one of the things you have to teach people, and I've had some troubles with that. I've had three patients that I had to disarm before every session when I showed up with a gun. Two were legitimate carriers. One was a private detective and one was a police officer. But the way they used it all during the session, when things got hot, their jackets would come open at just the right moment, you know. And those of you who do therapy know that there's some risk. Therapists get shot all the time. Famous analyst, a friend of mine's in Texas now. He used to work in San Francisco and had a patient came in and shot a .45 in his chest point blank, and he's amazed to be alive. He moved to Texas saying, crazy in Texas is not crazy in San Francisco. I don't know if that's true. I think I had my choice if I go to San Francisco. But it's a dangerous world. There's always the danger that people who are fragile and the ego gets flooded no longer can see the difference between literal and actual violence, and they get confused and identify with the literalness. But I would never advocate for a censorship of these strong images, because the images have to be strong and provocative and contain spaces that are going to affect our soul. They have to be.
I think much more of the issue is that we are creating rapidly a culture in which there is no community to take in the fragile and semi-psychotic aspects of humanity. And there has been, up until recently, in most cultures, and still is in many primitive cultures, a place for this kind of very fragile psyche, so that it doesn't have to be acted out in such a violent way. Now, how much of that might be connected to that inner child?
Well, it's a loss, again, of initiatory protected initiatory precincts. I think one of you, we were talking last night about male and female initiation rites, and I think we know a lot more about male than we know female, because patriarchy is kind of hiddenness. I think women are recovering that for us. But certainly one of Jung's most favorite examples in the collective works, he must mention this 5 or 6 times. You remember he talked about the Aboriginal tribe. He was real fascinated with unconsciously, where the young boys are taken out in a rite of being separated from the incest with their mothers and becoming men and taught the secrets of how to treat the earth and treat other men and treat women. One of the things is they actually have to kill the mother, and there is a symbolic act. They get around the vaginal opening in the earth. They all have phallic spears. They dance around it, probably counterclockwise. You know, Jung was always talking, alchemists talk about action, acta contra naturam, acts against nature. You actually, to go into the unconscious, it's an act against nature to breathe water again. It's an act against nature to go to the edge of a cliff in the middle of the unconscious sea and to jump knowing you're going to fall 20,000 feet. That's an act against nature. You don't naturally want to do something like that. And they dance probably counterclockwise, and they take these phallic spears and they jabbed it into the vagina. It says, kill mother's vagina, kill mother's vagina in Aboriginal. Well, that's a very violent arresting act, but it understood symbolically, it makes a lot of sense. And that these men were teaching these boys about how to have a space to do symbolic, imaginal enactments instead of literal ones, to build soul instead of destroy soul. But this poor man who had no healing, probably no ego container, and certainly no initiatory lodge to teach him, and nobody to prepare him to go in to see a film like that. So I think I'm hoping what we talk about in this class is that we go into films more consciously. I hope you start thinking about how a way to prepare your psyche for it to go in, how to receive the images, and how to meditate, just like with any kind of valuable experience in the unconscious, whether you have a vivid synchronistic experience or a dream, how to keep it conscious and hold on to it. So we were talking last night about the tendency for a lot of films, you see them and then you forget them. They kind of go on. It's hard to hold on to it because the images are so active and I think so intimidating. What do you do with that? What you do with a good dream? You journal it, you amplify it, you keep your feelings so you can keep the image conscious so that you can individuate through it.
I've always had a feeling about this, what goes on here on a collective level, is that maybe thousands of people that see something or that have an idea about something, and they give off some sort of vibration, say, that of hate or anger, and it's, for some reason one person will walk along to the south and become like the point of temper. They will erupt, whereas all these other people fantasize. I think that they will be erupt and to do the acting out, like the man who killed an 8 people, or something like that, and give us the great God we all want. That's about personifying on one level, the same as Mother Teresa would be on the other level.
Oh, I agree. And one of my career-long ambitions and desires is to integrate Jungian psychology in marriage and family therapy. Because I've been I was trained as a family therapist before I went into depth therapy. I've kind of been arse backwards in the training in our culture. And marriage and family therapists are very suspicious of psychoanalysts. They think it's real crazy. You sit with just one person and the real problem's in the whole family. And Jungian analysts are mostly disdainful about family therapy. The container spills, and how could you talk about the unconscious with the family? And I mean, this is terrible. It gets contained. Well, my belief is the family is the container for the unconscious. We have individuality in the family, but family's effective. And one of the rules in family therapy, those of you that do family therapy, if you get a family, and they always have somebody, the identified patient. It's really interesting how we pathologize that person. They're index. We're not trying to modify. The new language is index person, but it still is the old identified. Generally, the identified patient, the operating prejudice most of us, I think, would share is that's the healthiest person in the system. They are blowing and expressing the pain, whether they're usually it's an adolescent, steals cars, smokes a lot of cocaine, has wild sex. They'll do anything they can to get their family, and they care so much, they'll do anything they can to get the family in for help. I think I have a lot of compassion. And I think the street people, if you walk down a First Street, they're doing everything they can to call to our attention the crisis in this culture and the lack of heart and the lack of soul and the lack of compassion.
Lack of home.
And the lack of home, lack of place, a real home where the ego and the self are connected. Real home. This culture is sadly lacking in that. We don't have real homes in the Senate and in the White House and in Seattle. We don't have real home. Maybe one of the things we go to cinemas to try and find home.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.